from here on in, it really gets grim. For 99% of the people still left at this point, they're possessed with one thing: finishing. They're saying to themselves, if I can be standing at the finish, I've won. And they're right. But for the gifted few, for our 1% that are still competing, that are still racing, they're more than standing. They're wondering, can I catch that guy up there? What about the guys behind me? Are they going to get me? Are they coming on me? Are they picking up on me? Can I get him? Because let me tell you something. This is it. The last hour of this triathlon, on the pavement at 110 degrees, that's when we're going to find out who the hell the Iron Man really is.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We are brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series. That's toughmantri.com. By VeloFix, the world's coolest mobile bike shop. By Polar, chase your destiny. By Premium Plus Travel, the official travel producer, a provider for the Tough Man Triathlon Series. Our Challenged Athletes Foundation, we sent out 2,448 grants last year, totaling $3.7 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check out any of our interviews on Babbittville.com, on iTunes, and as always, Endurance Lives Here. One of our favorite athletes in the world. Last year, he pushed the pace at Kona, ran a 2:51 marathon, got caught in the last couple miles, but made that race really special. His name is Mr. Lionel Sanders. Lionel, how the heck are you doing?
I'm good, Bob. Thanks for having me on.
I love it, man. Hey, first of all, congrats. You and Aaron tying the knot. Now, where'd you guys do the wedding, honeymoon, or where'd you do all that?
Yeah, it was great. We were in Punta Cana, Dominican Republic, and we had a fairly large group. 35 people came out, and it was, you know, friends and family, and spent the week there and capped it off with the wedding. And one of the things one of my ideas for it was to, get people to do something perhaps they'd never done before. And so we had like a beach party and a dance party on the beach late into the night, and I thought it was a pretty cool experience.
So one of the things that impressed me the most about this year's race in Kona, a lot of times in Kona, because the field is so big and the pro field is so deep, there's a lot of sort of people looking at each other. They get on the bike and people are worried about getting caught in the draft zone, and so the racing part doesn't necessarily happen a lot. This year, it seemed like there was a lot of racing going on. Did you feel, I mean, this year was really the first year that you were at the top of the pyramid there throughout the race. What were your thoughts on the race?
Well, I certainly wasn't at the top of the pyramid any time during the swim, unfortunately.
Not that far back, though. And you were with the right guys. You're with Cam Wirth and you're with Sebastian Kienle. Those are good people to be with.
Yeah, it was interesting because I did enter the lead of that pack, and so yeah, I mean,
had you been in the
lead in that pack?
You ever led a swim pack before?
Well, usually I lead a swim pack of one, but no, not one with people actually behind me. And it was an odd experience because I know that those guys, a lot of those guys in that pack are better swimmers than I am, and I think they were just kind of content to let someone else do the work, and that sort of was the game plan. And quite frankly, I came there to win, not to sit in packs and stuff. And so I had to take that, I guess, upon myself. And so I swam as hard as I could, with the best technique that I could. And yeah, I mean, it was a little bit disappointing, quite frankly, because I know that had we shared the work a little more, especially on that back half, we would have been a lot closer. But that's probably one of the biggest gaps the second pack has had to the front of the race, if you go back and look through the history books. And I attribute that to me leading the pack.
Right.
So anyways, I mean, you just stay positive, and I knew I was with the bikers, that's for sure.
So,
I was quite surprised, actually, at how quickly we pulled the time back I mean, I guess it's from my perspective, it's a testament to the aerodynamic gains and the equipment gains that I've made, because I didn't really, in fact, I pushed less power than I did the year previous in that opening 80 or 90K. And yet, you know, the year previous, I think I came within like 2.5 minutes of the front by that point. And then, of course, last year I was
you're
in the lead by 90K.
Yeah.
So I mean, that was good. That was great. But yeah, I mean, it wasn't enough. And I mean, I made some mistakes for certain, especially on the descent. I remember Tim O'Donnell. Well, first off, Cameron Wirth came by me, and then yep. Tim O'Donnell came by me, and I was content to let someone else lead down the descent, because I figured I could watch them, and when they got hit with the crosswind, that I would know to brace myself for that. But it was a mistake, a tactical error, because Cameron just kept going and didn't slow down. He kept the pace on, and Tim kind of slowed down, and I just thought to myself, oh, you know, whatever, the descent's not too far, he won't get too much time. But by the time we got to the bottom, it was nearly a minute, him and Cameron and Sebastian had amassed. And I knew, you know, now I'm in the pack, basically.
Right.
And I knew that is not where I would like to be. And so I said, I saw the carrot out there, and I said, I wonder what it would take to catch him. And it took about 350 watts for 15 minutes to catch him. And that was probably quite a tactical error that could have been very easily alleviated just by going with Cameron. I don't think I lacked anything. It wasn't a very difficult descent that day. I just was content to be number two and let someone else in the event that there was a strong crosswind. Anyways, hindsight's always 20/20, and you know, there was a lot of damage done there. So coming off the bike, I mean, my legs from the first step did not feel very good. And of course, I mean, you always analyzing why that is, and now you know, I'm certain nutrition's playing a role.
Did you miss a,
so anyways,
miss a feed?
I just amassed the best yeah. run that I could, and I mean, through 10 miles, there was still hope.
Oh,
you know, looking at the splits, of course, you know, in hindsight, I only gave up 40 seconds to Patrick in the opening 10 miles, and I mean, I guess that's a testament to how well he ran those final 16 miles, because I gave back about 10 minutes in the final 16 miles. And anyways, I knew at the turnaround, I knew by probably 15 miles that I was not going to win that race.
Really?
It happened very quickly. Basically, the point where the desire to walk is screaming, and I was beginning to have trouble getting my right foot over the ground. It was starting to drag. The top of the foot on the ground, just due to mobility and that sort of thing. I knew the odds were not in my favor. And then when I saw Patrick at the final turnaround in the energy lab, I, without a doubt, I knew I was racing for second place now. So anyways, I did the best that I could. And you know, the beauty of finishing second is that your motivation is through the roof.
Way more than when you finished 13th or 15th, right? Because you know, I mean, listen, you ran a 251 marathon off the bike. And if Patrick runs 243, you win the race. I mean, you put him in a position where he had to run 239 in order to win by a little over 2 minutes.
Sure. I mean, I think I'm in the right headspace in this sport. And I tasted it, too. I mean, and this is how I know. I thought I was in the right headspace, but after that race, I was certain I'm in the right headspace, because I know that had I won, I still would not have been content, because I just made so many mistakes, and that run certainly is not what I'm capable of running. And so, you know, would I have still been motivated to make the improvements had I won? Absolutely, but not as much as when you get past with, you know, 3 miles to go and lose by 2 minutes and 27 seconds. So it makes your analysis a lot harder on yourself, that's for sure.
So when we chatted last year, at that point you were thinking, you know what, coming off of Gold Coast 70.3, listen, unless I can swim with those guys, it doesn't make sense to go back, right? It doesn't make sense to go back to Kona. If early on it was like you were saying you weren't going to go back to Kona until you really worked on your swim. When did you feel that, you know what, I'm swimming well enough to be able to be a factor in Kona? Was that when the race in Chemarin, when you came out of the water with Sebi?
Yeah, that was definitely where I mean, I had some glimpses at Oceanside last year. I was 2.5 minutes down to Yann Frodeno,
yep.
and only like 1:15 down to the front pack. But that was the absolute ideal situation, protected saltwater wetsuit swim, which is where you're going to swim your absolute best as a weak swimmer. And Samarin, the nice part about that race, it was still wetsuit legal, but it was fresh water,
yeah.
And I mean it was glass, but that was the next step. And then of course the next logical one was a non-wetsuit ocean swim, and then of course the hardest would be a non-wetsuit freshwater swim. And so Kona was the next and really the only opportunity on the schedule next to prove that I could swim with those guys. And so that's when I brought it back on the table, and that's when I booked the flights and looked for the condo, which did not exist because you shouldn't be booking your Kona accommodations 3 months before the race.
No.
But we found something eventually.
And I remember we chatted during the Breakfast with Bob show during the week leading in. Your one goal was come out of the water with Seve. If I come out of the water with Seve. And something you told me that I hadn't really thought about, when you talk about the Uber cyclists, guys like yourself and Seve, if one of you guys bridges, it makes it very difficult for the second Uber cyclist to catch up, because when the first guy gets there, the pace picks up. And so you have to be with Seve, or Seve has to be with you to be able to bridge.
Yeah, it's fine when it's mano a mano, but the reality is in championship racing, it is there had to have been nearly 20, 25 guys coming out within, let's say, 30 seconds of each other.
Yeah.
And the moment, let's call them an enforcer or something, hits the front of that race.
That enforcer is good.
Guy number two, sure, he has to lift the pace, and three has to lift the pace, and four, but the trickle effect only goes down, 8 to 10 guys. And by the time you get to 12 and that sort of thing, there's very little effect, though the entire, whatever you want to call it, pace of the race has gone up, let's say, 1 kilometer an hour or something like that. And so that's a huge problem, because now you can start to share the front. It's just pack dynamics of any draft legal race is what begins. And so unless, of course, you have something that happened this year where you had basically those two guys broke away and then I broke away and then basically the entire thing blew up.
Right.
But take Gold Coast 70.3 that year in 2016. Nothing ever broke up, and you literally had, a 20-man pack for the entire bike ride the moment Sebastian went to the front. And you had Andreas Dreetz, man number two, Maurice
yep.
Clavel, man three, great cyclists who they are going to get dropped by Keenlay, for instance. But the trickle effect is the problem. And then it's a problem for me, not for anyone who's in the pack. So anyways, that's how it goes. So you better learn that and learn how to race in that setting if you want to be successful.
So Cam Wirth, sort of the X factor this year. He raced there a couple years ago as an age grouper. Obviously, he raced a bunch of Ironmans this year. He won Ironman Wales. Had you raced him before? Did you have a sense of what type of cyclist he was?
Yeah, I raced him in Oceanside. I think it was perhaps his first 70.3 2 years ago, I believe. And I'm trying to think if I had raced him before. I certainly remembered Oceanside because I remember everyone talking about, professional cyclist
yeah.
in the field. And so that was the first time I raced him. And most definitely I'll expect a lot more from him this year because now he's not going to need to, hopefully he gets his qualification if he hasn't already and doesn't need to race 17 Ironmans leading into the thing and
exactly.
be, dead tired.
I know.
And plus, he's got all of the goods when you go for it like that. You need that in order to win a big race like that. And so, what a great first go at it, but I expect a lot more this coming year.
No question. Cause he feels that, he feels he's a good runner. He feels he can run better, certainly better than he did there, on that particular day. He was saying that when you guys caught up to Jan and that lead group, and then coming around the turn, he wanted to be right in front of Jan Frodeno. It was important for him to be in front of Jan and then make a move and sort of force Jan to either go or not go. Could you say, from terms of the tactics, did you, because the three of you guys were, you know, you dictated what was going on out there, you and Sebi and Cam. Did you have a sense of what he was trying to do coming around that turn and heading back to, down the hill?
Because I entered the lead, I would say about right before it's the pitch really goes up, going up to the turnaround.
Right.
And I put the pace on, you know, I knew I was in the front of a big pack. And so I put the pedal down pretty hard, probably 320, 325 watts all the way up. And I never looked back once. And then when I came to the turnaround, I saw I still had the entire pack with me. I mean, it was starting to split, but I saw the big players. I saw Jan, I saw Ben Hoffman, and of course I saw Keenlay and Cameron. But I knew that those guys, and I took solace in this because I knew that those guys had changed their race plan because of me, because there's no way they would have rode 325 watts up that side, and it's up the hill into a headwind, into a crosswind, so there was very little draft effect happening. So they were pushing that power on their own, you know, not due to the pack, and thus, I mean, they altered their race plan.
Sure.
There's no doubt about it. And so I took solace. It hurt me, but it must have hurt them too. And so when I knew I was never going to make a move on the descent, at least not by myself, and so I was content to sit number two. So when he went off the front, to be honest with you, it just happened so quickly. I wish I could go back and go with him because it doesn't really take much effort. You know what I mean? I was soft pedaling basically the entire way down in the number two position behind Tim.
Right.
But those guys were not soft pedaling all the way down.
No, and
they amassed a solid minute. But you know, what can you do? It's a tactical error.
Absolutely. Well, and that's the interesting part about that is that's what's so fun about it now. If you are sitting behind somebody and somebody's in front of them makes a move and you don't see it, that can change everything. Now you've got to push way more wattage than maybe you want to. And then it affects your run. So it's, I love the strategy and the fact that people were playing those tactics.
Yeah, I mean, the only guy who didn't really play any tactics was Patrick Lang. So maybe that should tell you something.
Exactly, because he could ride steady state.
He raced his own race. I mean, he did a textbook how if you ask a good coach, how should you race an Ironman, that's what he did. And obviously, he amassed the best time across all three disciplines that he could do. And myself, I amassed the best time across the swim and the bike, and I would say a subpar run. But that's because I put too much into the bike. So, you know what I mean? It's this game that we're playing. It's just a composite time. None of the single sports should ever be looked at on their own.
So when I look at, you start looking ahead to next year, and you've got, you know, potentially Andrew Starkiewicz, and then you got Andreas Dietz and Javier Gomez, maybe, and Alistair Brownlee, maybe. That changes everything, and knowing you, I'm betting you're going, having an all-star team like that would be pretty amazing to race against.
Yeah, I mean, I love the sport, and I love these if we want to call them golden arrows or something.
Yeah.
And I do believe, Gomez is for certain, he's already made that public, that's going to be his A race for the year. I mean, if we can convince Brownlee to do the same, we truly would be in, and then Jan's back.
Yep.
This would be a time I think that will be talked about for a long time. So just being alive and, somewhat competing against these guys, is a complete honor, and it's just an amazing experience. And you know, I think about it every single day in practice, and it would be a dream to, you know, have four or five guys going toe to toe. I don't necessarily know if I want to go toe to toe with Patrick Lang on the run, but toe to toe in the sense that we're all out there,
right?
Going full tilt. I think that'd be amazing, and it would make for some great coverage.
Oh, yeah.
And perhaps we can get a few more people inspired to get into the sport, too.
So are there points in these races, because people know your backstory, they know where you came from with drug abuse and alcohol abuse and turning your life around through this amazing sport of triathlon. Are there points in these races where you draw on that and draw on the low points that you had in your life to go, God, I'm so lucky just to be doing this?
I mean, the thing that I've learned probably the most is if there's much mental, stimulation or whatever you want to say happening internally, then it's probably not a good race. Because usually all that mentation is, oh my God, this hurts so bad, or oh my God, I'm swimming so poorly, or oh my God, you know what I mean, this and that and that.
Right.
And usually the good races, there's, you're in the moment. There is no thought. You just are. You are one with running or biking or swimming or whatever it is, and you're just. There's no energy to spend on thinking, and on the other hand, before the race, in order to push yourself to the limit, I believe you need to have your motivation in the right place, and most definitely, I am grateful for the new life that I've been given. And, I pay homage to that, and I try to inspire other people to, lead this great lifestyle that triathlon can give you. And so, most definitely, I feel like a totally different person than I was 8 years ago or whatever it is now. But during the race, if it's a good race, like Kona, for instance, I pretty much have no memory of thinking. I have a few thoughts that I remember for almost the entire 26 miles. And that's also, I think, one of the things what draws me to triathlon and to endurance sport is just that sensation of timelessness, and just being truly in the moment and one with the world, I guess.
So this season, what are the plans? Will you kick off with Oceanside again? I know you've already traveled and already won, but in terms of the march through the lead up to Kona, what will that be?
I'm going to spend a lot of time swimming, a lot of time in my endless pool, that's for sure.
That's cool. So now you have an endless pool as well as you've got your heat room and your bike trainer and treadmill and all the rest of it. You never have to leave the house.
Yeah, no, I know, actually. It can get you in kind of an odd headspace if you don't leave the house for too long. So you've got to force yourself to get out there if you have a personality like myself. But the endless pool has been great. It's been worth every penny in that. I have massively transformed my stroke for the better, both looking wise as well as pool time wise. And I certainly attribute a great deal of that to the endless pool, just being able to see myself in the mirrors. But anyways, now I'm starting to bring back a bit more pool swimming because I have made some big gains stroke wise, stroke mechanic wise. So it's time to put the load on a little bit in the pool. So Oceanside will be the first race, and then St. George again, and then the Samarin, the Challenge Samarin race again, which was a great event.
20 meter draft zone. How special is that?
Yeah, I got to support all the. If you're going to speak out about the current draft zone, then you better support the 20 meter races. So I will. And then I'll probably, like I did last year, I'll probably stay close to home for the entire summer. I did Mont-Tremblant 70.3. I'll probably do that again. And then I'll just take July for the most part to just get into some Ironman training. And then August, I'm not sure because ITU Worlds worked really well. It was in Penticton, in Canada this past year at the end of August. So it worked perfectly for the Ironman prep. But unfortunately, it's in July this year. So Yeah, doubtful. I can get into shape for that, or I don't want to force the issue. So I'm not sure what I'll do in August. And then once again, September, pretty much off from racing. And then I'll go to Kona a bit early, do my final little heat prep there, and then Kona.
So are you doing, when you're swimming in the pool, I remember one of the times we were chatting, you were starting to swim with some age group kids who were kicking your ass.
Yeah.
Is that still in the plan? That's sort of fun going in there. And
yeah, it was cool. It was cool. The only problem that I noticed, because I constantly am trying things and finding, what's the benefit, what's the problem. The problem with the kids is I'm so bad at swimming relative to swimmers. Like, I was actually, like, unless I literally started swimming with, like, the 7 and 8 year olds, which was... It took a lot for me to even. I had to get like a police clearance and everything to swim with the
really?
With the yeah the 15 to 18, because it actually is like a, I don't know, maybe it's Canadian law or something. I literally was the only adult swimming there. Anyways, it's just I was swimming so hard that it, and there was no thought given to my, like, I might have a 3-hour bike ride
right.
the night before, or something in my legs or my body. And it just was ingraining really poor technique. And so I got a bump for sure from doing it, just, I would imagine, due to fitness. But the ceiling is quite low on that. I mean, like, let's look at Josh Hamburger, who's the gold standard. I mean, he is like, I watched him in Kona at the pool. He's doing sets like for reps, 54-second hundreds, you know, leading on 120
yeah.
in the yards pool. But still, that's 1 minute. You know what I mean? He's just doing yeah. them over and over again, no problem. And there is no degree of effort I can put forth and do those. I couldn't do a single one. And so there's a technical gain that needs to be made, I believe, that I wasn't getting so much, just because the way the swim program generally works is, you know, 3 to 7, you work a lot of technique, and then 7 to 10, you start to bring in a bit of intensity, but still a lot of technique, and then 10, you know what I mean, to 15, now it's a lot more intensity, a lot less technique. And by the time you're 15, you know if you're going to be a good swimmer or not, you know what I mean? And so I'm swimming with guys who basically don't even do any technique sessions anymore. It's all intensity for
right.
the most part and,
yeah.
and various swim strokes. And so it just didn't work out. And so anyways, the conclusion I came to really after I stopped doing that was, I mean, I've been able to take my biking and running to world-class levels, so why can't I do it with my swimming? The reason I can't do it with my swimming is because I can't see myself. And that's why I bought the Endless Pool, and I started to, I guess, tear apart my stroke, and that's what I've been doing.
So do you have a coach working with you when you're tearing apart your stroke, or are you analyzing it yourself?
I analyze it myself, but I'm also back working with Jerry Rodriguez.
Yep, the best.
Who I'm on his he's got this remote
yes.
like coaching squad. And it's actually really great. Like, I'm really, really, really impressed. Basically, he sends you 4 workouts a week, and it's in a forum type thing. And then you put your results, like, of the main set down, and then your thoughts and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then he literally gives you his feedback on that. And for me, it works really well, because then I have the Endless Pool that I can analyze both the things that he thinks I should be working on with regards to tautness and, mm-hmm. and alignment, these words that he uses. And then also the things that I think I should be working on. I can put it all together in my tech swims in the Endless Pool. And then I can go to the pool, the real pool, and execute those workouts. And the whole thing actually works really, really well together.
Love that. So when you've had a lot of big wins in your career, but when you come in second in Kona, and that's the biggest platform in the sport, and you're leading a bunch of that race, you're leading enough of that race to actually start taking ownership of winning it. Did that change the awareness of Lionel Sanders? Did that change more people reaching out to you, more people knowing your story after that second place in Kona?
I mean, of course, you definitely have social media and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, you have perhaps people who never heard of you start following and that sort of thing. So we definitely had that kind of an increase afterwards. And I think also, I mean, people have been saying this to me. Fortunately, I didn't listen to them, but you know, basically they said, if you can't swim, you can never win Kona. Only front-pack swimmers can win Kona.
Well,
and,
yeah.
I mean, I've never believed
agreed
that.
With, no, I don't agree with that. Yeah.
But, you know, you got to go about proving that wrong. And so anyways, you always have the doubt, right, in your head.
Sure.
So this year, you know, I was pretty certain, but this year, you know, nailed it completely home that, I mean, you don't have to be a front-pack swimmer to win it. On the other hand, what I learned this year is that it's not the winning that drives me whatsoever, because I could taste it. I was leading, you know what I mean? I had the helicopter overhead, had the motorcycles in front. And that would not have satisfied me, just winning that race, because I still was 6.5 minutes down. That's, in my mind, it's terrible. And so I will not be satisfied until I make the front pack. And my bike, there's still lots to improve. And my run, I mean, maybe it's harsh on myself, but it was a very poor run performance. And all of these things, there was lots of nutritional issues. Those are what is motivating me, is to become the absolute best swim bike runner that I can be. And even had I won the race, it would not have fulfilled that goal. And so that is what I'm after. And so that's really what I took from that race, is that is the perspective you should have. That's the perspective that brings you, I guess, to the top. And that is the perspective that I will cultivate for the rest of my career.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting about that, I remember Peter Reed, also from Canada, 1 year when he won, he won by 2 minutes over Tim DeBoom. And he was upset that he only won by 2 minutes. Like you said, he didn't feel like he had a good race, even though he won. And one of the problems was then he took no offseason. He just went and started hammering and then ended up burning himself out and retired for a while. Even though you knew that, okay, I potentially if I had the run I wanted to have, I would have won the race, were you able to decompress for a little bit and, you know, really take that quality time off and recover? Because obviously that's a huge part of this whole game.
Yeah, I mean, I lost by 0.5%, 2 minutes and 27 seconds. That's 0.5% if you divide it into the length of time it took Patrick to finish.
Yes.
So to change really anything overarching, I mean, the training was right, the recovery was right, the blocks were right. I think a lot of the gains, I mean, I think there's a lot more than 0.5% left on the table. I think you could attribute 0.5% just to better nutrition. And so no, I changed nothing really. I mean, the only overarching thing that I learned and have changed since is that I wasn't doing virtually no riding in a time trial position leading into the race, basically because you can get away with that in a 70.3 where efficiency is coming to the forefront right as the race is ending. The problem in an Ironman is 4 hours, you still got a long way to go, and efficiency begins to come to the forefront. And if you've been, for instance, time trialing for 4 hours and you are not used to doing that, I mean, your glutes, your hamstrings,
your back
really start to lock up, especially on the run. And I mean, I factor that into part of that run split. And so, I mean, that's, I guess, where I'm at in that regard, not really looking for any overarching changes or anything, because I don't think they're necessary.
You mentioned nutrition. What mistakes do you think you made?
Well, 40% of the liquid that I consumed was water. So that is quite frankly, this was the first year coming into the race where I actually thought I could compete. And actually, I did my final block, and it was 10 days before the race. I did basically my quote-unquote long day. And I did the swim race. Actually, it was even before then. I swam the course, I biked the course, and then I ran 15K off the bike. And I was very depleted with the nutrition strategy that I had sort of concocted before that. And so I knew, oh my God, my nutrition is terrible. I have no idea what I'm doing. And so then the Saturday before the race, so 1 week before, I did the swim race, then I biked the course again, then I ran 10K off the bike, and I executed what I thought to be a better nutrition strategy. And I felt half decent on that 10K off the bike. And so I decided, okay, I'm just going to go with that strategy. I didn't have stomach problems. I didn't feel too bad. And anyways, I got into the race. I executed that strategy. And unfortunately, it did not get me to 26 miles. And yeah, I ran decently well through about 10K. And well, there was a lot more racing to go. So, I mean, you're going to be dehydrated, and it's very difficult to keep pace with your sweating. You definitely got to try your best on the bike to keep pace with your sweat rate. The problem is I was using on-course nutrition, and so what happens, because there's so many calories, I need to be taking about 3 bottles an hour, and I couldn't take 3 bottles of Gatorade an hour because that would get me like 540 calories at least.
Yeah.
And that's too many calories. That's gonna upset the stomach. I had to take water for one of those 3 bottles. And with hindsight, and I wish I would have done this, if you're gonna take pure water, you need to have some sort of electrolyte solution to go with it. No carbs in it, but electrolytes, because now you're putting in pure water into the system. The system wants to retain the water because it needs it to maintain fluid balance, but it also needs to maintain the electrolyte balance, so it starts to pull those electrolytes from the muscles, particularly unnecessary muscles like the quadriceps and glutes and hamstrings, which, you know, on the bike, whatever. On the run, though, every aid station, all I took was pure water, and I had my 2 little Gatorade bottles, and it was enough calories, but electrolyte-wise, it was massive deficit of electrolyte, and so the body was retaining it, but retaining it by taking those electrolytes, I believe, from the muscles. And thus, as the muscles were losing their electrolytes, they were basically not firing anymore. And that's why, if you watch that video, I mean, I can barely even lift my right leg over the ground. And that literally is just your muscles are literally stopping function. But how I know it wasn't carbohydrate is because when Patrick pulled up next to me, my mind was clear as day, and my brain was screaming, go, go, go. And my body had nothing left. And generally, if it's a carbohydrate problem, your ego is the first thing to go, and that's all ego. And so that's how I knew it's not a carbohydrate problem.
When, it looked like you were sort of dragging your leg along with you as you were running. And was that a cramping thing? Did that start early?
Well, I have a hitch in my step, my run gait,
right,
to begin with. But as you dehydrate and as you get low on the electrolytes, I mean, the muscles rely on electrolyte in order to, you know, salt and potassium, magnesium, calcium, in order to fire, in order to function. And as you get low on those, I mean, you literally are going to lose function. That's why we get all those great inspiring videos of guys literally crawling to the finish line because their legs no right. longer work anymore. And oftentimes that's you know, massive electrolyte deficits and imbalances. And I think that's what was happening to me.
Now, when Patrick, in the energy lab, you saw Patrick, you saw how he was running. And it's funny, I remember one year, Thomas Hellriegel, going way back, he had taken the turn and was on his way back. And he saw Luke Van Lierde, who ended up, you know, winning a race. But he saw Luke, and I said, how did you assess Luke? He says, well, Luke took one look at me, and then he stopped and walked to the shoulder and took a pee. And
yeah.
I knew he was thinking, this guy is not going to be a problem. I can stop and take a pee, have lunch. When you saw Patrick, did he just look amazing?
He's built for that race.
Right.
He that is his race. And so, you know, you gotta accept that some people are going to they're gonna dominate in those conditions. And so yeah, he looked like a million. He looked like he could have run another marathon. And I mean, you know, you gotta come to terms with that, and you gotta figure out, you know, what can I do? How can I compete with this guy? And so, I mean, one of the things you can use that as inspiration. So his run form is absolutely beautiful, some of the best I've ever seen. And so, you know, I'm going to use that as inspiration to try and improve my run form. I'm probably some of the worst running form you've ever seen. And so, I mean, he looked phenomenal, and that's very intimidating.
When I look at that race, I look at it that you, similar to Dave Scott when he lost to Mark Allen in 1989, Dave did everything right? He basically broke his own course record by 18 minutes, ran a 240 marathon, and lost. You did everything right. I know you can look at it and say, I had nutrition issues, I had this or that, but you put yourself in a position with a 251 marathon to seal the deal. And it took somebody breaking the course record and running a sub-240 marathon to win.
Sure.
So when you look at it, you sort of have to look at it and go, okay, I'm there. He just had the run of his life. You tip your hat and go, great for you, Patrick. Next time, it's going to be mine.
Totally. I mean, that was everything I had on the day. There was nothing, without this hindsight,
yes,
there's nothing I could have done to improve upon that performance. That was everything I had. I mean, I have, like, memory loss for half of that run because there was no function in my brain. I was pushing so hard. So, I mean, absolutely, there was nothing I could do. I never would have beat him, and phenomenal performance. But every performance, every race, good or bad, there's always going to be lots of lessons if you're attuned to them. And, you know, like I said, the beauty of, you know, I was on pace, on verge of achieving my life dream. The beauty of falling short of that is that you put literally everything under the microscope and analyze everything to the best of your ability. And that is, I guess, the gift of finishing second in a race like that.
Love that. Well, we've seen it a lot. People finish second and they come back and win the following year. You know, you look at Pete Jacobs, you look at Craig Alexander. Over the years, we've seen that over and over and over again. You sort of learn how to you know, you learn what it feels like to have the chopper overhead and to be able to taste it, feel it, and feel like you're taking ownership of it before somebody rips it away.
Sure. One of the beauties, too, of Kona contesting it on the same course year after year, year after year, same conditions, which is great. It's great that it's in a part of the world, actually, that doesn't really change. So you can count on it being about 90 degrees Fahrenheit and, you know, 70% humidity that day with no cloud cover. For whatever reason, I was there for 15 days before the race. It was cloudy every day, raining, and then the day of the race, not a single cloud. Hottest day of the whole time, for whatever reason. But you can count on that.
Yep.
You can count on a tough bike. And so the beauty is you can really, you know, prepare for this race specifically, whereas, you know, come to Ironman Mont-Tremblant, one year it might be 90 degrees, the next year it might be 60 degrees, you know what I mean? Like, it's just so all over the place. And so I think that's really one of the cool parts and why it's so meaningful, the history and everything, because it is just the same thing over and over. So you know when you hear these stories of Dave and Mark running the low 240, I mean, that is just ridiculous to do that in those conditions. You know what I mean? It's unfathomable, really. So it's pretty cool.
Well, and the other thing is that if the conditions are worse, right, if it's windier, that's good for you. Right, if it's a tougher bike ride, that potentially will take more out of the running guys.
Well, if you look back in the history books, I mean, it seems like there's one ridiculous day every 10 years
it
or
is.
So.
Yep.
And I've been there now. I started first year in 2014. I went and watched the race. So this will be 5 years. And it's been very little wind every single year. So we're due.
We are
soon,
due.
Soon, one day, you can only hope in your career to have a ridiculous bike ride day, and that would be a lot of fun.
You know,
on the other hand, I'd like to win the thing on the easiest day, just because I don't like these excuses, if you want to call them that, of, oh, it was the perfect circumstances for you to win, blah, blah, blah.
So what's funny is the friends of mine who put on Ultraman and volunteer in Kona for the Ironman were out on the course the next day on that Sunday, and it was so windy they couldn't pick up the trash. They couldn't get the bags to open because the wind was howling on the Quinque.
I mean, the disc wheels are banned for a reason. I mean, I don't know why, but I can't picture why, but apparently the disc wheels are banned because sometimes there's 60, 70 mile an hour crosswind that literally will pick you up and throw you off the road. So, I mean, that's what we could potentially be up against one day, which would be quite an interesting challenge.
I love it. Hey, Lionel, I appreciate you always being so kind with your time. Thank you so much for chatting, and give my best to Aaron, and we look forward to seeing you in... Oh, you'll be here. We'll be doing a Q&A with Tri Club of San Diego on that Sunday, and hopefully we'll get you in the surf again with our kids from the Adaptive Surfing Program.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It'll be a great time.
I love it. Lionel Sanders has been our guest again. We're brought to you by ToughManTry.com, VeloFix, the world's coolest mobile bike shop, Polar, Chase Your Destiny, our Challenged Athletes Foundation. And you can check out any of our interviews on Babbittville.com or on iTunes. And as always, endurance lives here.